Hurricane Florence is heading for the southeastern United States, but the storms over that anonymous New York Times op-ed and Bob Woodward's new book hit hard over the weekend in Washington, D.C. On Insight, I'll talk about this with Ken Rudin, the political junkie. The Kavanaugh confirmation hearings wrapped up, too. We'll discuss that as well. A budget submitted by the Sac City Unified School District was disapproved. The district has a $24 million budget shortfall to deal with. The superintendent and board president will join me to discuss it. We have a CAL FIRE update on Northern California wildfires, and September is a dangerous month for fires. Also, Governor Brown's climate summit starts Wednesday in San Francisco, but a related symposium on climate change and ag is happening today at UC Davis. I'm Beth Ruriak. That's ahead on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruriak. We are in a gap right now between the confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh, which wrapped up last week, and a confirmation vote, which isn't yet scheduled. In that gap are a few storms. A storm over that anonymous op-ed published last week in the New York Times, and a new storm over Bob Woodward's new book to be released Tuesday. It's titled Fear, Trump in the White House. And that's where we begin our weekly chat with the political junkie Ken Rudin. Hello, Ken.
Good morning, Beth.
So Bob Woodward's book isn't out yet, but in excerpts, it documents incidents within the White House in recorded interviews with people he knows and he can identify. What's your take on this book?
Well, you know, Bob Woodward, as we've seen in all the books he's done in the past of previous presidents, he does have a stellar reputation. He does get people to talk. And, you know, something I think for all the pushback by Trump and loyalists to his administration are pushing back against it, it sounds like everything that we're, the irony, I guess, is that everything we're reading in the book, or at least in the excerpts of the book, are not surprising. I mean, as we're talking about an administration in dysfunction, that's just not working, that a president who seems just out of touch and not curious, and a lot of dishonesty being spread in the administration. It seems, again, not unusual, but I think the fact, I'm hearing an echo of myself, but what I'm hearing, what I'm seeing in the book, though, is that an administration that just seems to be not telling the truth and not working well with others.
Ken, he said today, Bob Woodward did on the Today Show, this is Trump talking, acting, and deciding. And here's some of the conclusion from Bob Woodward as he told Savannah Guthrie.
Well, I've never seen an instance when the president is so detached from the reality of what's going on.
So he's comparing this president to the many, many administrations that he's covered and the many interviews he's done about the different administrations. I'm going to ask you, Ken, a question that I've asked you before, most recently with Omarosa's book. What is the importance of this? And I'll say that adding that Bob Woodward is framing this as it pertains to national security and intelligence.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, there, of course, is the Michael Wolff book, The Fire and Fury, and the Omarosa book, and James Comey wrote a book. And with this book, I'm not sure if it says so much about national security and intelligence as it does about competence and honesty. So I think what's interesting about this book is, one, as I said earlier, Woodward's stellar reputation for getting to the facts. But the fact that it's all in one, I think when you have the book coming in within a day of the anonymous op-ed in the New York Times, it just seems like it's just showing that, look, even with President Nixon and President Reagan and all the conflicts and the rivalries that went on within the administration, there was never the complete disdain for the president that I'm seeing now. And so whatever you want to make about people plotting against the president, about stealing things off his desk so he can't implement them into policy, I mean, that's kind of that's unprecedented. So whatever you think about the stuff we've heard about in the past, I think Woodward, I agree with Woodward. We've never seen anything like this, especially with a president who is just so widely disdained by so many people he brought into his own administration.
You're referencing an incident described in the book in which Gary Cohen lifted a document from the president's desk. He said, as a protectionist move. But let's listen to a little bit more of what Bob Woodward said this morning on the Today Show relative to what we're talking about.
This country does some things in the intelligence world which are so important to protect the country. They are astonishing. There is secret. They are called special access programs. And he jeopardizes them. He jeopardizes the position in the economy by doing things that experts, you know, 99.9% of the people say, don't do tariffs. It doesn't work. He's got it in his head. And when people challenge him, he'll say, oh, I've had those ideas for 30 years. You're wrong.
Savannah Guthrie asked Bob Woodward, do you think the president is unwilling, incapable? And I don't know if you heard the interview, Ken, but he said, listen, I describe what happened. And that's what journalism is. There are some conclusions.
Exactly. And that's what Bob Woodward does better than I mean, sometimes in previous books, Bob Woodward will reach conclusions and perhaps editorialize. But I think the most damning thing about Donald Trump is that what Woodward's doing is basically saying what happened from those involved in the administration. And when you mentioned what Gary Cohn allegedly did by removing stuff from the president's desk. Not only was Gary Cohn, you know, the former head of the chief economic advisor, not only was he seemed to be a likely source for much of what Woodward wrote about. But if you also look at the op-ed, the anonymous op-ed in The New York Times, with so much focus on the president's betraying Republican principles and conservative principles by his views on trade. That was always a bugaboo for Gary Cohn. So I wonder, you know, in all the guessing game in Washington, who wrote that anonymous, you know, op-ed in the Times? Was it Dan Coats? Was it Don McGahn? I'm wondering if maybe it was Gary Cohn because he seemed to write it, even though he's a former administration official. The New York Times identified this person as an administration official, so I don't know if that means present or former. But a lot of things he wrote about, especially regarding trade and economic stuff, almost seems to point to the direction of Gary Cohn. But who knows? You know, it's so funny. Everybody's asking everybody. They're all denying it. But of course they're all denying it because they wrote it anonymously. Right. So when you say, Mike Pence, did you do it? He'll say no. You know, Dan Coats, did you do it? No.
Well, Mike Pence said he'd take a lie detector test over it. His no was that emphatic.
First of all, Mike Pence seems to be the least likeliest of anybody to do it. Mike Pence, you know, is just the way he's described in the book, and he's described in another book by Michael D'Antonio about how almost subservient he is to the president, how he'll just sing his praise at every cabinet meeting. Mike Pence is the last person on my list.
So Savannah Guthrie asked Bob Woodward whether he thought the anonymous op-ed could have been written by anyone that he, Woodward, spoke to for the book, to your point about Gary Cohn. He said, none of my sources are anonymous. I know who I talk to. They talk to me. Gary Cohn's name is in the book. So he said he doesn't believe that's the case.
No. That's not what he's saying. I think what he's saying is that if you the difference between anonymous and the people he's talked to is that Woodward said, look, I know who I talk to. So the people who gave me insight, including Gary Cohn, I mean, in other words, it doesn't whether Gary Cohn wrote the op-ed or not is not what Woodward is saying. Woodward is saying that unlike the New York Times guy, I know who I spoke to, and that includes people like Gary Cohn. I don't think he's really discussing.
We heard that a little differently. So you think it's possible then, and you already said this, that Gary Cohn could have written the op-ed?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, especially given the focus on economic issues and trade issues, which, again, is in Cohn's bailiwick. Yeah, absolutely could be that. But again, you know, everybody, of course, denies it. When Mark Felt, who was the deputy director of the FBI during Watergate, who turned out to be Deep Throat, we didn't learn that until decades later. But when he was asked, he said, absolutely not. So of course they'll all say no. It just seems so funny that everybody seems to have breaking news that Joe Schmo or Mary Schmo said that no, they were not anonymous. But of course they'll deny it, because that's why they wrote the article, the op-ed, to begin with, to be anonymous. Or as the president would say, anonymous. I think that's what he said. He couldn't pronounce the word anonymous in a rally, and it was kind of funny.
Well, we've all had trouble with words, Ken, so...
Not me, no. I don't mean to be anti-semantic,
I'm not going to act that I don't get tripped up too, so especially on that word. I'm talking with Ken Rudin, the political junkie. Let's look back at George Papadopoulos being sentenced. He'll spend 2 weeks in jail, right?
2 weeks in jail, which is, you know, probably more than most. But I mean, basically, he lied to the FBI. He repeatedly lied to the FBI when he was interviewed by them in January of 2017. And a lot of this investigation into Russia, the FBI said he just really threw them off the track, and it was really detrimental to what they were trying to accomplish. But at the same time, George Papadopoulos is allegedly cooperating with Mueller and the investigation. So he got more of a sentence than most people do, but 14 days, I think the severity of what he did made him deserve the jail sentence. But the fact that he is allegedly cooperating with the investigation makes us think that he may be a more pivotal figure than just somebody who's sentenced for 2 weeks in prison.
And now to the Supreme Court confirmation hearings, which have wrapped up. Can you believe they're this far down our list of topics today?
Well, you know something, every week we say that, you know, we would say, let's see if there's a lot to talk about next week. And there's so much to talk about. And the Kavanaugh nomination is certainly one of us. But here's what's interesting. For all that we've seen with Brett Kavanaugh in the several days of hearings, when he was blistered by the Democrats and a love fest from the Republicans, for all what seems to be questions about his honesty and his memory and his philosophy and his record, when all is said and done, what changed? And I don't know what changed. We do know, or we think we know, that maybe Cory Booker and Kamala Harris and Amy Klobuchar are running for president. We kind of established that. But did we change any senators' minds? And that's a good question. So ultimately, if the goal of the Democrats was to get two pro-choice Republicans, Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, to consider voting no. If that didn't happen, and I'm not sure if it did, then ultimately for all the vitriol and the anger and the back and forth between the two sides, I don't know what really changed in that, which means that Brett Kavanaugh is likely to become the next Associate Justice of the Supreme Court.
Well, it has to happen by a vote. We don't know yet when that vote is coming, right?
Right. I mean, the new Supreme Court term starts October 1st. Mitch McConnell has said often that there will be a vote in time for him to join the court by October 1st. And I'm assuming anytime, you know, perhaps the last week of September or even sooner. I mean, there will still be a debate in the Senate. But unless we get some kind of a signal from Collins and Murkowski, because you need two Republicans now to vote no, or you need two Republicans to vote no, even if all the Democrats stay on board, then we have some action and activity and suspense. Barring that, I don't think anything changes. And you still have the specter of possibly Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota and Joe Donnelly of Indiana, maybe another Democrat, voting yes. They also voted yes for Neil Gorsuch. So, again, you know, he was dented. There was a lot of arrows aimed at him, but he seems to have survived, at least as of the confirmation hearings in the Judiciary Committee.
All right, Ken, we have primaries that we can talk about. I'm going to save that for next week and kind of wrap it up right here with us being, as I said from the beginning, somewhat in the gap with storms approaching and all around us, right?
Yeah, unless there's another major story that we're going to have to deal with next week. It happens every week, doesn't it?
Thank you, Ken.
Thank you, Beth.
That is Ken Rudin, the political junkie. You can find a link to his website at capradio.org/insight. This is Insight on Cap Radio. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. The Sacramento City Unified School District is the 13th largest in the state with more than 40,000 students. 2.5 weeks ago, as the new school year was beginning, the district's budget was disapproved with a $24 million shortfall. In the studio with me is the district superintendent, Jorge Aguilar, and the school board president, Jesse Ryan. Jesse, glad to have you here. Superintendent, glad to have you back on Insight.
Thank you, Beth.
Superintendent, how did this unfold, and how much of a surprise was the shortfall?
Well, the first thing that I want to mention is that this has been something that has been in the works in terms of understanding that as ongoing expenses have risen, we have higher pension costs, we have higher healthcare costs as well. The County Office of Education, as our fiscal sort of oversight agency, has simply said that for 18-19, our budget is fine, but that this is an issue related to the out years. This is about 19-20. This is about 2021, and the importance of making sure that we're reining in the costs given those increases.
Is there a budget shortfall then in the current 18-19 budget?
No, 18-19 is fine. Their responsibility is to certify that our budget is also healthy up to 2 years out. And they have said to us that based on their review of our budget, we would fall below the state mandated 2% reserve that we have to have on hand, which is why we are working very closely with the county office. They have appointed a fiscal advisor. We'll also work with the fiscal crisis team from the state, looking at ways in which we can become more efficient, nimbler, of course, all in the benefit of our students, of course, which is what attracted me to come to Sac City Unified to work with this Board of Education. And that's what we intend to do.
There's a sense of an element of surprise here. Were you surprised by part of this, Jesse? Were you and the board surprised?
So I will tell you, for the last 4 years that I've been on the board, we have been talking about whether or not we have the long-term fiscal ability to meet our obligations. One of the things that we're very clear about is that while we've done a fairly good job of ensuring that we are setting aside savings to plan for the future of our children, our obligations have not been enough to really meet the revenue that has been coming in. So our obligations have actually exceeded the revenue that we've been able to bring in the district.
So you submitted a budget. It was disapproved. Did you anticipate it was going to be disapproved?
We had a sense of it because, again, this is about the out years. We have enough in our savings account today. We have about $60 million in our savings account. But the ongoing expenses are currently exceeding the state revenues.
Can you expand on that? Specifically, we have this number, $24 million. What's in that $24 million?
Well, the $24 million really represents the difference between how much it's costing us to operate the district and the revenues that we're receiving from the state. For example, we are paying more in pension costs this year. That will exceed about $50 million this year. We know that our healthcare savings have increased about 6.5% over the past 5 years. We, of course, have unfunded liabilities, commitments that were made years ago. And we are certainly leaning forward, making sure that we're looking very closely at our budget so that we can be in a position where our ongoing expenses are exactly where our revenues are at.
So there is a sense, and maybe the word should be stronger than that, that this shortfall is being created because of the settlement you negotiated with teachers last year in order to avert a strike. And then in hindsight, that settlement could have been made knowing it would put the district in a budget shortfall. So then the question becomes, why was it made? So I'd like each of you to respond
yes.
to that.
No, I'm happy to speak to that. So I will tell you, Beth, that when our superintendent joined the district, we were thick in the process of contract negotiations. And I think that there was a general sentiment that we have amazing teachers in Sacramento City Unified and that we needed to do everything in our power within our means to settle the contract. When the superintendent joined us, we were already in the process of fact-finding because we were fairly wide apart between what we felt we could expend financially and what was being asked for. $86 million was the request, and we were coming in much lower than that, anticipating that we wouldn't have revenues in the out years. But the public outcry was clear going into the November settlement. We heard loudly from community stakeholders, from parents, from students. They wanted to avoid the trauma of a strike at all costs. And so 2 days prior to the date that was set for a walkout, we did come to an agreement. And that agreement was an agreement that we felt was generous for our teachers. But while we could afford it for this year, looking at the out years, looking at the long-term ability to continue to sustain those commitments was a very real concern.
So yes or no, did you reach that agreement knowing it was going to create a future shortfall?
So we have actually had, based on past administrations and boards, obligations that also have created the potential of a future shortfall. Our board going into this was fairly confident that we would be able to cover these costs.
So you did know it might create a shortfall, but you thought they could be covered? Is that a correct
yes.
description?
So, and please, Superintendent, feel free to add. One of the big challenges with the way the state budgets our K-12 education system is that we are overly reliant on one-time funding. And so for the past few years, we've had to use one-time funds, which are monies that come in for 1 year to cover expenses. But quite often, those are for ongoing expenses. So we are able to meet those financial obligations that year. But the ability to pay for it in subsequent years is always a challenge.
I will also add.
And I want you to back up, Superintendent, and address that same question. Is you were new, you went ahead with a labor deal. Was the agreement with the understanding that you could be creating a shortfall, but it was more important to avert the strike?
Sure thing. And please understand that, as President Ryan just mentioned, this is about capitalizing on an opportunity to build a much more robust, structurally sound long-term budget process. What I was able to see very clearly is that we were relying on one-time funds for ongoing expenses, and that's just not a healthy way to operate a district. This Board of Education has leaned forward and said that we are going to capitalize on this opportunity to work with independent voices. SCOE is an independent voice. The fiscal advisor that they've appointed is an independent voice. FICMAT is an independent voice. And we're going to have to figure out how do we rein in some of those ongoing costs so that when we receive one-time funds, those are treated as such. They're put into our savings account so that we can be prepared for an economic downturn and such. But we will not continue to depend on those one-time funds for ongoing expenses.
Now you have a situation that emerged last week, and Board President Ryan is in communication with the teachers' organizations, as you are, Superintendent. What happened at the end of last week and as this news became public? President Ryan?
So, you know, as I've been speaking with community members and parents, there is a huge desire that we clarify the gravity of the fiscal situation. There's been a lot of misinformation. Many individuals don't understand that we actually have the finances to cover this year's expenses, that the real concern is the multi-year budget, how we afford our 20-year, 2021 year. And so we have really said, We are looking at this as an opportunity to find efficiencies, to, in the spirit of full disclosure and transparency, work with an independent fiscal auditor, which is assigned to us by the Sacramento County Office of Education, at no charge to the district, to do a deep dive into our budget and to tackle in a way that I believe past administrations should for decade, long-term planning so that we're meeting the needs of our students, not just today, but for their future.
Jorge, this is particularly personal in a way to the district, too, because you're new and there's been a lot of turnover and there may be some distrust.
Yeah. First of all, let me just say that before my role as superintendent, I'm a Sacramentan. I adopted this community, uprooted my family, and am proud to be a Sacramentan. So it's personal in that regard. My four children attend this school district as well. And it's also personal because everything that we are doing, Beth, is with a lens of equity, access, and social justice. Every investment that we're making is to meet the needs of our students. Our summer school program, which we decided to cut for next year, given the severity of this situation, was intended to help students during the summer months when in communities like Sacramento, students struggle coming back to school. For those that were not demonstrating grade level proficiency, we invested in that. We invested in providing students the opportunity to take the SAT, to take the PSAT as well. These were all initiatives that we leveraged resources from grants currently. But as those grants end and we expect those to end, we need to be in a position where we have the resources available to continue to meet the needs of our students and provide opportunities that without the district, they might not have. There's cost to taking the SAT. There's cost to taking AP tests. And these are things that I believe the district has an obligation because of our commitment to the principles of equity, access, and social justice.
So is summer school in the district in jeopardy next year and possibly years beyond?
It absolutely is. In fact, because we took this so seriously, Beth, we knew that we should start making some cuts in the 18-19 fiscal year so that the cuts potentially in 19-20 and 2021 wouldn't be as severe. So we made cuts to the tune of almost $5 million this year, anticipating that this might occur and making sure that we weren't in a position where we'd have to take much heavier and severe cuts in the out year. So I took the unusual step of presenting our budget as superintendent to the Board of Education on June 21st. Normally, that's the role of a CBO, because I could tell that this was a serious matter. In March, we put out a publication for our community letting them know that this was a serious matter. A few weeks ago, the SACB put out an op-ed where I announced that this was a serious matter. We then got this letter, which is saying that this is a serious matter, and we're going to continue to treat it as a serious matter, but all with a lens of advancing equity, access, and social justice for our students.
You're listening to the superintendent of the Sacramento City Unified School District, Jorge Aguilar, also the school board president, Jesse Ryan. We are discussing the disapproval of a future budget. How do I characterize the budget then, other than just a future budget? If it's not the 18-19, are there specific years for this budget?
This is for the out years leading up to 20 to 21. So it's for the 19-20, 20 to 21 academic years. We are, again, leaning forward. We're very grateful that at the board meeting last week, four out of five of our bargaining partners formed a consortium, knowing that this was a serious issue and that we would collaborate with one another. Today is the first day in which the appointed fiscal advisor will spend her entire day with our new chief business officer as well. And we will be meeting with them. They have said that they have ideas about how we can get through this together jointly in the spirit of collaboration. And we're very grateful for that gesture.
Ms. Ryan, that sounds like teachers who were given a contract and a raise in negotiations last year might now be willing to look at some cuts because of this shortfall. Am I reading that correctly?
Well, we're certainly hopeful that our SCTA bargaining partners will be part of the consortium. I will tell you, when we sat down with our four bargaining partners on Friday to discuss the gravity of our fiscal situation, what was inspiring to me and different from the dialogues I've heard in the past was really a willingness to engage in some shared sacrifice. What I heard loud and clear is that this is a difficult situation, but that they had ideas and wanted to be part of developing the solutions and prioritizing the best possible cuts if we have to make these difficult decisions.
Mr. Aguilar, how does that translate for
you? You know, first and foremost, I'll say as superintendent, I think that folks will be very envious to be in a position. Imagine being a superintendent where four out of five bargaining partners come to the table and say, we want to form not a coalition, but a consortium, not to fight against this, but to be with you in the fight. Absolutely thrilled and excited that's what we have in Sac City at the moment.
I'm imagining this in hindsight, though. You go back to a district on the brink of a strike and the public outcry to avoid a strike. You want to give the teachers something they'll agree to. What if that component of, but it's probably going to cost summer school over the next couple years, or it's going to cost other cuts that directly translate to the education of your children, then what? Could you have framed the conversation a year ago in that way?
Well, that's, I mean, certainly how I've always framed this conversation. You know, as President Ryan mentioned, the difference between what was being requested and what we felt we could afford, there's still a huge gap even today. And that's because when I decided to take this position, I was deeply inspired by a Board of Education that said loud and clear that they were committed to this vision and a guiding principle that rested on the principle of advancing equity, access, and social justice. And so everything that we've done in the past year has been with that in mind. I'll just want to go back again. As a result of having paid for the SAT for every one of our juniors during the school day, we now have a couple more hundred students that are eligible going into their senior year, which they just started, eligible to apply for colleges and universities. We'll have more students take AP tests that weren't taking the AP test because each of them costs $90. In a community like Sacramento, one thing that I've been able to appreciate is that the forces that are at play currently that I've been able to appreciate are such that we have many families that are struggling that can't afford to pay for an SAT, that can't afford to pay for an AP test. And I believe that that is in line with this mission around equity, access, and social justice. And that is what many organizations, civil rights advocacy-based organizations, would want Sac City to be investing in.
President Ryan, and this is the same question to both of you to wrap this up. How confident are you that that October 8th deadline for a response to deal with this budget shortfall and adjust the budget can be met?
I'm fully confident that we'll meet that deadline. I have to tell you, Dave Gordon and the Sacramento County Office of Education has been such a proactive and present partner in this. They have really told us, you know, this is a preventative measure so that you have what you need to meet the needs of students in years to come. So that means that we will roll up our sleeves, get to work, find efficiencies. That means that we'll have to be nimble. We'll have to work with our bargaining partners and our communities to ask, how do we prioritize cuts? How do we ensure that our very deserving students have the resources they need in the classroom and beyond? And I think that there is a willingness to do that and do that in this very tight timeline.
Superintendent Aguilar, same question.
Absolutely. I mean, this is such a wonderful opportunity for us in Sac City and for this entire community, Beth, that we are going to take on and we are going to lean forward. You know, I'm so deeply humbled when people ask me, are you a superintendent that's only going to be here 3 to 4 years? And I insist that I don't intend to do that. But with that, we are going to have to capitalize on these kinds of opportunities so that we make tough decisions now and see the great benefits that can come from a structurally sound budget processing that leads to long-term sustainability, because the ones that will benefit are our students and this community. And so we're going to stay very focused on that mission.
Well, thank you both for this conversation. We'll have to reconvene in October as we see what happens going forward. I think it is important for us to reiterate again that the budget that was disapproved is a future budget and not the budget for the current school year.
Absolutely.
Thank you for having
us. Thank you. And again, from the Sacramento City Unified School District, that is Superintendent Jorge Aguilar, and from the Board of Education, the President, Jesse Ryan. There is more background on our website, capradio.org, and this is Insight on Cap Radio. Listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruiak. California's historically worst wildfire month has now begun. It's the month of September. We have at least two plus big wildfires burning in the northern part of the state, and they're challenging firefighters right now. On the phone with an update is CAL FIRE Chief Mike Moeller. CAL FIRE, by the way, is an assisting agency to some of the blazes that are in the U.S. Forest Service, and that agency becomes the lead firefighting group. But Chief Moeller, glad to have you with us, and you are again the Deputy Director of Communications for CAL FIRE. Thanks for your time.
Good morning, Beth, and as always, thank you for having us.
So a new fire started in Napa County over the week. This is called the Snell Fire. Let's begin there with the statistics. What's happening with this fire?
Yes, this is about 7 miles southeast of Middletown. It's about 2,490 acres. We're happy to report 30% containment. We still do have some mandatory evacuations in the Snell Valley area and also Berryessa and Knoxville Road area. Crews have been making great progress on it, and we're hoping the weather cooperates through today.
The Delta Fire had closed a stretch of I-5 for quite a while, more than 40 miles. I understand that situation has changed. So that's up in Shasta County. What's happening with the Delta Fire?
Well, CAL FIRE, as you explained beginning of the show, we are in unified command on the Delta Fire with our federal partners. We're at 47,110 acres. This is in brush and timber, 5% containment. Very difficult access. We still continue to have impacts on Interstate 5, so we ask your listeners, please check the traffic reports prior to going in that area. But this, unfortunately, Beth, is going to be a very difficult firefight.
Is that because of the terrain, because of where it is?
It really is. It's everything on this one is the fuels, brush, timber, the topography, and then the weather that we're experiencing in that area has just unfortunately just made the recipe for a large fire. Again, we continue to bring in additional resources to combat it.
So the temperatures are supposed to drop this week. Are the winds a factor? Tell me more about the weather impact.
No, great point. We are looking at temperatures to drop in some areas up to 10 degrees, but we're still experiencing what we would consider the normal winds. Depending on where the fire is on the Delta, we are going to get winds that will affect the firefight. We still have a lot of open fire line when we say 5%. So, yes, with the temperatures going down, that is a benefit to firefighters, but we still have to look at humidity levels and then obviously the winds. So, again, Mother Nature, as you well know, plays a major role in this firefight.
Help me with a locator to know where structures or community areas where people are living could be threatened as this fire expands.
Well, right now, evacuations continue in communities of Delta, area of Volmers, Pollard Flat, Sims, and Castella. Those areas residents should be aware. Again, follow all evacuation orders. Stay tuned on additional information as it comes out. But if you're in any of this area near the Delta Fire, really, like we've seen, it's the fire conditions are so explosive, Beth, that we really need the public to take heed of any type of warning, and if asked to leave, do so early, so not only we can get in there and protect property, but just for the overall safety of the public.
Chief, I think there's another fire in Shasta County, too. Is it the HERS fire?
The Hearst fire, and we're happy to report again that was an assist to the U.S. Forest Service. That is 100% contained. We do have another fire on the Shasta Trinity Forest. It's called the Curlin Fire. That's over 1,700 acres, 30% or 31% containment. Still a threat to some communication infrastructure, but again, happy to report crews are definitely making progress on that fire also.
And I saw that the Sligar Fire in El Dorado County is 100% contained now. So I mentioned that September is this most dangerous fire month. Will you say something about that and how we have such an extremely cautionary period ahead of us over the next couple weeks?
We really do. And unfortunately, as we've seen in years past, and you and I have talked about it, there is no more fire season. It really is a year-round operation. But not only here in Northern California, but September through the fall months can be some of the most critical fire weather in Southern California, as we saw the Thomas Fire in December of last year. We had a Santa Ana wind event that was 14 days long. That was one historical, history-making weather pattern. And unfortunately, we're coming into those months again, and the fuels are right where they were in 2017.
All right, Chief. Well, I always appreciate your time. Thanks for the update today as we begin another challenging month and challenging week, and we'll speak to you again.
Yes, thank you, Beth.
That is CAL FIRE Chief Deputy Director of Communications, Mike Moeller. And you can find continuing coverage of California's wildfires at capradio.org. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. Listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. A major announcement is going to be made by Governor Brown in about 10 minutes. There's speculation that the governor will announce that he's signing SB 100, the climate change legislation that's sitting on his desk. I have a brief interview window scheduled with the governor at noon today, and you'll hear that conversation on Insight tomorrow. Meanwhile, Governor Brown opens his International Global Climate Action Summit this week in San Francisco, and an event affiliated with that summit is happening today on the UC Davis campus. It's a symposium titled Managing Land in a Changing Climate to Improve Agricultural Resilience, Food Security, and Health. On the phone with me is the California Department of Conservation Director, Dr. David Bunn. And Director Bunn, I'm glad to have you today on Insight with us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So who's coming to Davis for this event today?
Scientists, practitioners across several areas, experts in agriculture, in food security and in health and disease, because these issues are all very linked.
Is there a focus to the climate change and agricultural conversation, or are you going across a big landscape?
Well, there is a focus. The focus is how do we manage lands to basically improve agricultural resiliency, food security, and health. In other words, it's really about how do we manage the lands and the impacts they have on these other issues. So, that's the kind of the core of the conversation today.
You're also looking for ideas, though, and dialogue on future planning, aren't you?
Absolutely. So, you know, in California, we do land use planning, but we need new methods and techniques to preserve the most important agricultural lands in the state. I mean, the fundamental goal here is how do we protect those lands so we can produce food far into the future.
In the drought years, we had a lot of fallow acreage. Is fallow land a strategy?
I don't think it's a strategy, but it's, you know, it's a consideration. As lands go fallow from drought, we want to make sure the lands go fallow or lands that have the lower value in terms of their productivity for agriculture. And what we want to do is make sure we have water available for the most productive lands.
To what degree, Director Bunn, is California's place as a leading agricultural state and the capital of the farm-to-fork movement at risk because of the impact of climate change?
Well, California, like the rest of the world, is going to experience fairly significant changes to climate and water availability, and therefore we need to be prepared to adapt to it. In other words, come up with new technology, new strategies of how we actually manage the landscape, so that we produce food at a higher level than we are today. So it's a lot about land use planning, but there are other methods that will be discussed here today.
Well, I guess I'm asking about the bumper or the cushion around what we're already experiencing and the technology and solutions that are in place to offset our changing climate.
Well, I'm not sure there are bumpers. I think, you know, we there's a very serious topic because, you know, the climate will be changing and agriculture is very dependent on the climate. So it's very, very important that we look very carefully at it and we bring the best minds to the table and ranchers and farmers who actually produce the food and know so much. So it really, ultimately, I think the most important thing we can do is bring people together that involved in agriculture from all aspects of it. You know, we really need to bring all the voices to come up with solutions that are effective.
The governor insists and continues to drive California policy in a way that California becomes a leader. Do you feel that you pick up that same mantle in the conversation about agriculture? And does the voice on climate change and ag need to be a leadership voice coming out of California?
Absolutely. The governor is quite a leader, and working for him, that's the ethic he instills in us who work for him, that basically we always should be pushing the envelope and we always should be on the cutting edge. And you know, many of the things we achieve here in California will often be adopted by other states and other nations. So we play a very important role in the world.
His summit is the first here in the state. Has this symposium or some variation of it happened before at UC Davis?
No, this is the first symposium of this type because it's directly affiliated and associated with the summit occurring later this week in San Francisco. So it's a unique gathering here.
Demonstrations happened. We're seeing scenes and sounds from yesterday. The estimate is more than 30,000 people in the street. Is there any demonstration activity on campus today?
Haven't noticed any yet. I think it's mostly focused down in San Francisco. And I think, that's most of that demonstration, I think, is very consistent with what the goals are of the summit. It's talking about, expressing the concern over climate change. And I think everybody involved in the summit and all the affiliated events agree that's a really important thing to highlight right now.
You're right. In fact, Director Bunn, some of the message of the demonstrations has been be more aggressive, do more. So if I apply that to your focus, climate change and ag, what about becoming more aggressive and moving faster and differently?
Well, I agree with that. I mean, I think we have to, for example, there's one thing that deals with reducing greenhouse gases. The other end is how do we adapt to the change? And today in this conversation at Davis, we're looking at what are the things we need to do to more aggressively prepare to adapt to change. And so we really need to push it. You know, UC Davis is like the number two agricultural university in the world. It has the number one veterinary school in the world that works on diseases associated with animal production around the world. So we have been on the forefront of the campus here, and they will continue to be so. But I think really this part of today is a call that we really even need to step that up even further.
I feel undereducated in how the minds are going to come together in the management of lands. Can you give me an example of a specific problem or direction that some of the conversation will go for me to better understand it in a literal sense?
Sure. So one of the most important impacts on agricultural lands is sprawl from cities, for example, in the Central Valley. And sprawl has two types of impacts. One, it increases greenhouse gas emissions because people commute further to work to go out to the rural houses scattered all over the landscape to go to work in the city. The other is it reduces our capacity to grow food. So on the adaptation side, it also has a negative impact. So on the what we can do, for example, at counties and cities, our land use planners, it's very important that they have the tools, the information, the knowledge to understand what the impact is of their land use decisions. And our department in the last couple of years, for example, has developed a new tool for planners in California. It's called TerraCount. We're previewing here today at the symposium. But basically, it's a tool for land use planners to see any land use decision they make, what impact will it have on agricultural conservation, water use, and other benefits we're concerned about.
So TerraCount is the new tool?
Okay. The new tool.
All right. Well, hopefully we can find a link for more information on that. And related to the governor's action, are you expecting him to sign SB 100 today?
I think there's an announcement at 10. I'll let him make that announcement.
You handled that very well. Your symposium, is it open to the public? Are there any sessions that are today?
It is. You have to register, but I think you can register if you walk in, so that's fine.
Okay.
It'll be going all day and until 7 this evening.
All right. Well, again, with all that, I appreciate your time today, Dr. Bunn, and hope that we can continue this conversation.
Great. Thanks so much.
That is from the California Department of Conservation, Dr. David Bunn. He is the director, and we're talking about that symposium. We'll post a link in case you want to jump in and attend some of the sessions today. And again, that announcement is coming up by Governor Brown in just about 2 minutes. You can follow it on CAP Radio, and we'll have my conversation with the governor tomorrow on Insight. That's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. Our producers are Jen Picard, Cody Drabble, and Bert Johnson. Our technical director is Mark Jones, and our executive producer is Joe Barr. Thanks for joining us. We are back with another live show tomorrow.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.